This conference will now be recorded.
Hello, this is Reading Odyssey's Herodotus 2014-2015 call. It is Wednesday, October 15th, 2014, and tonight we will be discussing books 2 and 3 of Herodotus. I am Rebecca Kennedy, and I am the moderator for this group. Before we start, we'll have everyone please go around who has called in tonight and just say your name so that we know who all is here. And we'll start with Bill and go in the order. We'll just go as we go around, all right?
Hi, this is Bill.
And where are you calling in from again, Bill?
Nashville, Tennessee.
That's right. And then Leah?
Hello. Calling from Portland, Maine.
And Katarina?
Hi, I'm calling from New York.
And Fred?
Oh, Orange, California.
And Andrew?
Hi, calling from Houston, Texas.
And is there anyone else who's joined us since I got those names down? Okay, well,
hey, everyone. It's Alex here, calling in from Greece.
Hello, Alex. All right. So hopefully we'll start getting used to what everyone's voices sound like. So I wanted to go ahead. I know that books 2 and 3, well, 2 especially of Herodotus, can be a bit daunting. But I tried to keep the questions sort of broader this time and a bit more open-ended so that we can sort of think about how we want to approach this discussion, especially of book 2, which is what we refer to as the Egyptian digression. So I'll go ahead and let's go ahead and start with Bill. And maybe if you want to give us some of your first impressions about the reading of book 2 on Egypt, and then after about 15 or 20 minutes discussion of book 2, we'll switch over to book 3. Okay? So Bill, what do you think?
Well, it was pretty amazing to see the breadth of the discussion. I mean, we had geography, calendars, origins of peoples, engineering feats, floods, how the Nile works, religious customs, and then the comparison of the gods and the hint that somehow the Hellenes, the Greeks, got a lot of their gods from the Egyptians, and then into the dynasties. It was pretty amazing breadth and scope of discussion, tying things together.
It really is. And you sort of hit on some of the big things, of course. One of the things we can talk about in a little bit are what we actually, what he gets wrong and what he gets right. Some of these are pretty funny. I'm sure you guys caught on to some of them. Leah, what were your thoughts about book 2?
I thought book 2 was indeed daunting at first. But once I sat down, relaxed myself, and began to read it, I found it very conversational, much like mm-hmm. book 1, which set me at ease. I noticed he talks a lot about animals and animal sacrifices and mm-hmm. And religious customs and how the Greeks apparently stole everything from the Egyptians. They stole a lot of their gods from the Egyptians,
word.
And I thought it was interesting. Yeah, Bill said that already, but and it's also interesting stories of like clever Egyptian kings and tomb robbers, and it was a little bit of everything, and I really enjoyed it personally.
Katarina, what do you think?
Well, I enjoyed the details. I thought it was amazing just how much he was able to record, whether it was true or not. I think one of the things that makes it's such an intriguing book is that the details make it so authentic. So you really feel you're in good hands with him. And I think this book filled in a lot of the blanks in terms of motivation for some of the characters. I think by understanding mm-hmm. the culture and the geography and just getting a bigger piece of the pie, you have a better idea of where these people were coming from. And even when they do these outrageous things, and sometimes they act like animals, you see there's just, there's a connection there. There's a sort of a universe of all of this happening at once where there's this parallel universe almost. So I thought it was really interesting in that respect.
Thank you. Fred, how about you?
Yeah, I liked it. I didn't get all the way through 3. I've been involved in campaign stuff, but I mm-hmm. did get all the way through 2 and the beginning of 3. I really enjoyed the anthropology of it. You know, the what was going on in the different cities and when the different cities and the cultural things, and you know, one city in Egypt actually had everything like Greece, where the other cities didn't. You know, some of the things were hilarious, though, about, you know, his description of, you know, how men and women go to the bathroom in Egypt is different than in Greece. And, you know, some of the descriptions, like the grave robbing, and that was kind of fascinating. He gets on these tangents where he describes things like the, you know, how the fish come to be born in the marshes, where he tries to plant this a little bit. And, you know, obviously we don't, you know, he's not 100% right, but.
Right. Know. Hello?
Yep. That's
oh,
it.
Sorry. It got so quiet so quickly, I thought I lost you guys all. All right, Andrew, what are your thoughts on this?
I think this was one of the most fascinating things I've ever read in my life. I'll probably go back and read book two again at least once.
You have
but,
to. It's so much in there.
It's really like taking a journey into another world, and it's remarkable, to repeat what the first caller said, the breadth and the scope and the realization that nobody had ever written like this before. I mean, if they wrote something like this now, it wouldn't be that exceptional, but of course, modern Egypt or any other modern country would not nearly be so interesting as Egypt circa 400 BC. So I thought the entire book was remarkable and too much to comment on. It's strange, bizarre, and fascinating simultaneously.
Yeah, and I'm sure everyone's going to have their sort of little favorite moments, but there really is so much in here. Alex, would you like to contribute this evening?
Sure. To be honest, I didn't really like book two so much. I preferred the stories of book one. But I thought it was remarkable how, he's been called the lover of barbarians. Yeah, I can see why. And there are multiple instances where he calls the Greeks silly for their beliefs, especially regarding the length of history. And he seems quite convinced by the Egyptian arguments that they're quite old. It's also really funny to see the limits of knowledge, because obviously some things he writes are really factually correct, while others are completely out there.
That's a great point. So I like how you phrase it too, the sort of limits of knowledge of what was available to him. Has anyone else joined us since we have started talking? I don't think we have anyone else. Okay. So just sort of as we're sort of thinking about this, I think one of the things that came out from everyone's comments is that there seems to be a lot, pretty much anything about Egyptian culture that seems to count as worth recounting for Herodotus in many ways. But I think one of the things we actually want to think about, if we sort of want to look at, maybe start with question one and sort of blend it in question two and three in some ways, as you guys were sort of bringing up the things that seemed to be of interest, obviously religion is a big issue for Herodotus, something he wants to talk extensively about. And the anthropology aspect, the religion, of course, falls under that. But there's also geography, what we would consider physical science. What were some of the aspects of this that, what do you think he's actually doing when he selects what to put in here, I guess, is what I'm wondering. What's his method, if you want to think about it that way?
He seems to be really indiscriminate about what he puts in there. Like, anything he hears is game, basically. And that's what results in the really uneven actual nature of the text.
And how about Leah? What do you think?
Could you repeat the question?
I'm just sort of wondering what you think you can sort of draw out of this reading of what you think Horatius' method is for selecting what he puts in and for how he packages it or addresses it for his audience.
I think for Herodotus as a person, I think he just put in what he felt he learned the best and found most interesting. I mean, I know that I remember stories and facts I find interesting just for me. So I think maybe a little bit of that, maybe just his own personal likes and dislikes. And I also think that, you know, he's pretty Hellenocentric, I think it's safe to say. And he talks a lot about how the Greeks got their gods from Egypt and a lot of their customs from Egypt, and how he likes the Egyptians, I believe. I think he likes them a lot. He almost speaks of them fondly at part. So that's my two cents.
Thank you.
Getting a lot of echo.
Yeah, I am as well. I'm not sure why, but I think it's because we're all probably on different types of phones and we're getting feedback. Fred, what do you think? If you want to throw your two cents in here.
I think he puts the various cultural aspects in there because he really likes the Egyptians. The amount of detail that he does in book two versus what we had in book one with the Persians is really really amazing. Yeah, and you know, just the detail of what it takes to go up the Nile and how the different cities up the Nile are different is remarkable. I think he's in awe of their, you know, what they accomplished, obviously, with their pyramids and other things. So he's happy to attribute a lot of things in Greece to things they did in Egypt because he's in awe of their culture.
Katerina, what do you think?
I think that when I was reading this, what struck me more than anything was how he's stressing, I think, as a storyteller, the importance of observation. And I think also as human beings, how it's important in life just to be a really good observer. I mean, I think that's probably the best way to approach anything. And the book has this feel of being a long meditation. So I think it works well like that. And so I think he includes details that, you know, sometimes he'll throw a curveball and a story will just go into a totally outrageous dimension where you don't expect it to go. And then other times it seems really tame and historical. And he doesn't really, he doesn't censor himself too much except for things he considers sacred or religious, or there are some things where he has boundaries. But other than that, it seems like everything is up for grabs. And he's sort of observing, comparing, contrasting. I think we get that when he talks about the different political systems. We get an idea of maybe how he wants to engage the reader in a kind of deeper meditation, to look at things from different angles, kind of like the way we might explore truth in life, because, you know, we'll never really know the absolute truth about anything, but we can know the relative truth. And so
right. It
sort of brings me back to his opening. And now I know why I like the opening. I think he basically sets up, he sets up a story and he allows the reader entry into it at all these different angles and to make it personal for them, to help them feel more invested in the story by, you know, using their own mind to draw a conclusion. So that's my thought.
Yeah, it's interesting that you use the word observer, because one of the things that has been pointed out a lot about if you read Herodotus in Greek, when Herodotus talks about how Greeks engage with all of this world, and when he talks about his own engagement, he uses a lot of words that are about that are words for seeing into things, so that it's examining. He's always examining things, words that have this sort of layered meaning, whereas when he uses the language of seeing for Persians and others, they are sort of more gazing at it as if from a distance, so that Herodotus sort of sets himself up as a person who looks into things and examines things. So it is really about this sort of type of observation that you pointed to, which I think is really great. So what do you think about Herodotus's approach to the world here and writing of his history?
Well, it's an extraordinary verbal picture, and I would suspect that for people who did not have the ability to visit the geography, this is a great synopsis and image to hear or read. It's great the way that he does step off to the side and, as someone I think already mentioned, allow you to make the journey yourself. He only interjects a little bit when he says, this is something I saw, or I consulted the oracles here or there to verify his information. I particularly like the part where he talks about what the custom was and starts to paint the foundation that custom is king for how people behave and how people are going to react. It's just a great tale. It really is.
Yeah, one of my favorite parts actually where Herodotus sort of asserts his eyewitness status is when he mentions hippopotami, and it's clear that he actually never saw one if you look closely at the way he describes them. But it's quite possible that he saw a painting of them, because if you just sort of, if you go onto the internet, onto Google, and you put ancient pygmies, and you'll get these wall paintings from antiquity, and they show the hippopotami as having sort of clawed feet, and they sort of look like horses, but with clawed feet and sharp teeth, and they live in the water. When is he asserting his own, I saw this, and how much should we take that for truth when you see these sort of blatant falsehoods in some ways? Maybe he saw a picture of a hippopotamus, but
I just Googled it, and oh my goodness.
They're my favorites. I love the ancient Nile scene. My favorite one is from Pompeii, and it has a pygmy on top of a crocodile attacking a hippopotamus. It's like a war. It's very cute.
Oh my gosh, I just Googled it. Oh my goodness, is that a crocodile? It looks like a dinosaur.
Hey, it's a crocodile, yeah.
That is beautiful.
But it sort of gives you this idea of, you know, he is inviting you to come along with him, and he is describing these things of people that he knows will never have an opportunity in all likelihood to ever look at these things and to ever see them for himself, so he wants to provide as much detail as possible. Perhaps even when he doesn't necessarily have it, he still wants to take you on that journey with him. Andrew, what do you have to add here?
The hippopotamus paragraph, by the way, is paragraph 71.
Oh, thank you. I was flipping around.
That whole section I really like, because 72 gets into other sacred animals. 73 is the legend of the phoenix.
Yep.
74 is the sacred snakes of Thebes.
I love the snakes too.
And then 75, we get to the infamous flying serpents of Arabia.
Yep.
This is what I like about Herodotus. It's precisely what the stuffy historians of the 19th century hated.
Exactly.
Was his total, to them, lack of method. And his everything and the kitchen sink style of writing. To them, a historian shouldn't have even repeated the stuff about winged serpents or phoenixes or any of these kind of mythological things. Oh, how horrible it is that Herodotus was repeating these silly myths. But this is an invaluable document of what people in Egypt actually believed at that time. They really believed there were winged serpents. They really believed in the phoenix. They apparently really believed that the hippopotamus was looked like a horse or a dinosaur or something. Some of them, anyway.
I often wonder if he got so far, he got to Elephantine or something, and he saw a representation that was represented that way.
Yes.
That's one of the things I've wondered about.
Yeah, and that gets back to what we were saying about Book One and Herodotus in general. People really wring their hands over whether he was a historian or a mythographer or whatever. The folkloric aspect of this entire book is very important, and it should be noticed that a folklorist is a historian. A folklorist is somebody who goes around and talks to local people and collects their beliefs and writes them down. That is a type of historian, and I think it's fantastic that Herodotus talked to these people, wrote down their beliefs. The phoenix might have been a completely mythological animal. It doesn't matter. What matters is this is what people believe. That's what they told at the time, and I'm glad he included all that stuff.
Yeah, it's in some ways, you know, you brought up the stuffy 19th century historians. As they were sort of fighting to define their own field as a respectable scientific discipline of some sort, they felt almost that they had to reject Herodotus. And it's always a cautionary tale when we try to impose our modern definitions about what someone should or shouldn't be or what they are onto these ancient authors and these ancient texts, because they didn't play by our rules. They played by their rules.
Exactly.
And so who are we to say that the first person that the Greeks considered a historian wasn't a historian? To the Greeks, he was.
Exactly.
And to the Romans. So let's go ahead. I think because we're getting close, we could actually talk about Egypt and this material on Egypt all day. It's absolutely fantastic. But I wanted to move into chapter 3 and maybe especially talk about some of the Cambyses material, because here we sort of get the moment where Herodotus goes into this big, huge digression on Egypt, not without reason. He's giving us this tale because it fits into his tale of the Persian Wars, because the Persians themselves are going to expand into Egypt at this time. But before we sort of move on to there, and to, of course, the famous custom is king scene, which I think will directly relate us to what he decides to do in Egypt, I wanted to just sort of give you a little heads up preparation for the fact that when we get to Book 4, which will be for the next call, we're going to encounter the Scythians. And the Scythians, so the Egyptians are considered the oldest people on Earth. The Scythians are the youngest. And when we, in Book 4, or in Book 2, he sort of sets us up for how he actually views the structure and geography of the world based on the flow of the Nile along with the flow of the Ister, which is the Danube. And this is in, let's see where it's at. It is in paragraph 233 on page 132. And so he actually views them as running parallel. So that we're going to have two parts of the world that the Greek world is sort of centered in. And you'll have the youthful Scythians with no cities and their nomadic lifestyle. And then the ancient Egyptians with their gigantic pyramids and their tombs and their long established rituals. So sort of just be thinking back to Egypt and how Herodotus situates Egypt in the world when we get up to the Ister. And to the Great Scythian Desert, as he refers to it. So sort of a preview of where we're going to be going and where Herodotus takes us, so you can sort of see the integrated structure of these two books that are separated by Book 3. So let's go ahead then, and we'll go back, I think, to we'll go back to Alex. Do you want to start us off thinking about Book 3 and some of the material in Book 3 and what you said you liked Book 3? A bit better, or you could do like Book 1, but Book 3 has many similarities. Do you have any thoughts about
Before about we move to that, I have a quick question about Book 2 in paragraph 50, referring to he says the Egyptians don't worship the Osquia, and at the end he says that the Egyptians do not believe in heroes at all. What exactly does heroes mean in this context?
Oh, Herodotus, when he means heroes, he means humans who were descended from divinities. So, for example, Achilles, who has a tomb, Agamemnon, Ajax, people who weren't deified, they sort of lived in between the human and the divine world. Now, when a hero died in ancient Greece, especially if they died in battle, they were considered to be what we call the restless dead and angry because they were dead, because they sort of wanted to be divine but weren't. And so there were cults associated with heroes where you would have to sort of appease them with offerings on a regular basis. Usually these were local cults in various Greek cities. So you would appease them with sacrifices in order to prevent their angry spirit from haunting the city.
Isn't he saying, though, although he doesn't explicitly state it, that the Egyptians don't believe in the Greek heroes? The heroes of the Iliad and the Odyssey and so forth.
Yeah, this is one of the things that you always have to sort of keep on your radar, is which words are left out of Herodotus, what's implied. And is it implied that they don't believe in Greek particular heroes? We don't know there doesn't seem to be any evidence that they had hero cults as the Greeks would have understood them. So the question would be then, for Herodotus, the only way he can understand hero cult is as he knows it as a Greek. And the Egyptians don't have. So yes, it's they don't worship Greek heroes, but they don't understand the concept of hero as a Greek would altogether.
What I thought.
Yeah, because that's one of these instances where it's totally filtered through the fact that he's a Greek, and he assumes this as a given. And somehow or other, the Egyptians, oh my gosh, they don't get that. How did they not know that they weren't Greek? Okay, Alex, did you want to go ahead and pick up on book three, or do you want to pass that off?
Sure, why not? It's basically a continuation of book one, mm-hmm. both in terms of history and thematically, sort of how fortune affects people and how thing that goes up must come down again. Cambyses is quite an interesting character. the descriptions are a bit humorous. Herodotus calls him somewhat insane. It's just a bit of an understatement, really.
I've always wondered about Cambyses, because when you get to the Roman historian Tacitus, he reminds me a lot of Caligula. And I also wondered if Tacitus is borrowing from Cambyses to make some of his crazy Roman emperors. It's very, yep. very.
Well, I've heard that very discussion in historian circles, that Herodotus is just repeating what anti-Cambyses polemicists are telling him in Persia, and that we shouldn't actually believe any of this is true, or if it is, it's greatly exaggerated because it's coming from Cambyses' enemies.
I mean, this is something to think about, what Herodotus' sources are for this information. It's going to be Egyptians, and or it's going to be Persians, or Lydians, or Greeks who live under Persian control. So the question is, are any of these sources that he has access to, are they ever going to be not hostile to Cambyses?
Yeah.
These are biased sources that he is most likely using. We'll come back. I want to come back to something before we finish for today. But let's go ahead and see what Leah's thoughts are on book three. And any particular scenes that you want to pick out, or any of the questions that you want to address on book three.
Probably my favorite part of book three was the rise of Darius and the seven magi slayers and the, what's his name, Pexastes. So Otanes proposed democracy. Megabizos proposed oligarchy, and Darius proposed monarchy. And I thought that, Rebecca, your question number five for book three, really, I spent a lot of time thinking about that question. You know, is that tyranny? Is that a monarchy or despotism? And I'd love to talk about that. That really interested me.
Yeah, and I think we should probably premise this whole conversation with on this issue of the debate of the constitutions, as we refer to it, with the fact that the likelihood that this debate ever actually really took place and that Herodotus was able to hear about this is probably slim to none. So if you think about it, this is a set piece that Herodotus has manufactured. So there's got to be a really good reason for why he did this, right?
Yeah.
Well, the reason might be nothing more than just telling a good story.
Yeah, he's clearly a master, but there are threads that run through, I think, that we want to think about. If you connect this monarchy, despotism, tyranny, oligarchy, democracy, mob rule, he's got all the sort of angles in there. But this is connected in a string where you have a sort of string of good government followed by bad government, right?
Yes.
So we have Cyrus, who's the good king. And then we fall into Cambyses, who's the bad king.
Yeah.
With the founding of Persia, you have the Assyrians overthrown by Deiocles, and then the establishment of a tyranny, and then you sort of have the ebbs and flows. And we're going to see Darius is a pretty good king, and he's going to sort of denigrate into Xerxes, the bad king. So there seems to be a process that Herodotus is trying to sort of play with a little bit. Does anybody want to take up the question of the debate of the constitutions and what that might mean for the rest of the book, or how we want to think about this transfer of power?
Basically, I ended up not finding an answer to this question, but I did find myself with an ultimate takeaway. And to me, the ultimate takeaway of this story was Darius cheated with his groom in some way or another to make his horse make a noise, which would make him win the contest of who would be king of the oligarchy. And I think that is Herodotus' message, that Darius cheated. So the origins of this monarchy are in cheating.
Yeah, so it's all in some ways illegitimate, maybe. I mean, clearly
yeah.
We're supposed to take this as illegitimate, I think. Who else wants to add something in here?
Well, I think it's uncontroversial to say that some Persians in the 5th century were having discussions about democracy. That just simply didn't happen. As to why Herodotus inserted that in his story, I can't really say. I think he's often putting Greek ideas in the mouths of Persians and Egyptians. To what end? Maybe he just thinks it tells a better story. Maybe he has no information at all about these characters. Who knows? But I really enjoyed that section as well. It starts at paragraph 80 of book 3, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Andrew, do you want to add something? Are you?
So that was Andrew speaking.
Oh, that was Andrew. That's what I thought. I thought that was you. And that, you and Bill both have the same loudness on my phone.
Oh, sorry.
Sorry about that.
It's not you. It's my phone. It's not that you have a clear connection. Fred, are you still on there?
Yeah, I am, but I didn't get into book 3 and didn't finish the reading. I got through 2.
Is there, Katarina, are you still on or have you had
I'm
to
here.
Already check
nope.
out?
Yeah,
okay.
No, I'm here.
Can I add anything in?
I mean, on that debate, for me, again, I just thought that was an example of him encouraging the reader to meditate more deeply on something, sort of to pause and say, okay, think about this, think about that. But what I did enjoy about book 3 was the polarity between the characters of Croesus
mm-hmm.
and Cambyses. I just thought that was really masterfully drawn, whether it was intentional or just, it added a lot. And I think we're seeing some payoff from book 1 where Croesus, I think it was Solon, I guess, had that discussion
Solon.
About the fortunate man and how you can judge whether someone's fortunate. And I think now we're seeing Croesus in the role of advisor, where he's managed to turn all these negative experiences into wisdom, which kind of seems that he may be headed in the right direction in that sense, in terms of living a life that might somewhat have fortune at the end. And, you know, I thought that was interesting, because he's in such a contrast to Croesus and, there, you know, lunacy and wisdom. And so I just found that really an interesting part of the book.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's
you
really
said
great.
It. All right.
Yeah,
that's a great connection. And one of the things that I was talking to a student about this the other day, because we're doing this role-playing immersion game in ancient Rome, and he is the elder member of the Roman Senate. And I said, you know, your job is to always pretend that you have advice and wisdom to give, because this is a long tradition in Greek literature where there's always an elder man who has great wisdom and advice to offer that nobody wants to listen to. they don't understand it until it's too late. Like, you start with Nestor and the Iliad, and then you have Croesus and Solon, and
so there you have the Greek tragedies
forward.
All of them line up.
That's right. Nobody listens to the elder man, right?
Or no one understands him.
If he did, if he doesn't have a cane and start shaking and going, "You kids these days, I don't listen." So what about the big push, sort of the big central set piece here that is mentioned in question four, about the scene about custom as king, and sort of how the story of Cambyses, since we're talking about Solon and Croesus and advice, how might this story actually rest into that notion of the sort of wise advice? And what do we do with this custom as king of all, given the way that Herodotus has actually structured his history after you've just finished reading the Great Egyptian Digression? What does he mean by custom is king of all? Anybody want to chime in on custom is king?
Well, this is Bill. It almost appears that regardless of what ruler is in place or what activity is going on, the bottom line trigger for the behavior of peoples and civilizations is the customs they follow. He seems to make that point several times in there, and I think it's in 338 somewhere that he makes a point that this is essentially how people will always react.
It's sort of often viewed as this passage is often viewed as the sort of origins of cultural relativism.
Yeah, and if you understand the customs of the people and the way they're going to react, then you'll probably keep yourself out of a lot of difficulty. If you don't, that's at your own peril.
You set yourself up to be a Cambyses.
Definitely.
Exactly.
Yeah, this is Katerina. I thought that at first I thought that's true. There's no subtext in that line. But then I thought about it more, and I felt like maybe he's saying you really can't escape your heredity. I mean, that. Mm-hmm. That sort of sense of predestination, which runs through this book, it takes a lot to really rise out of, you know, all the obstacles in life and, you know, become the hero of the story and this and that. But I think he's really saying something to that effect, where you really can't escape certain things. Custom is key, heredity is key, you know.
You can't escape the hands of the gods.
Yeah.
That's right. The gods will always be there in these books. It's interesting. One of the things that, you know, you sort of bring up the issue of heredity, and one of the things that the Greeks actually had an issue with, not all Greeks, but some Greeks, and then the Romans especially later on, is the actual concept of hereditary kingship, that monarchy isn't necessarily itself bad, but that there's something about the sort of passing it on to the next generation. That there seems to always be something defective about the son, the one who comes after, in some ways. I want to think about both of the sort of key passages that we've brought up, the custom is king passage, as well as the debate on the constitution, and think about, instead of thinking about how these are comments on Persia or on Egypt or on other cultures, how we might think about Herodotus using these as ways to think about the Greeks themselves. Because remember, in this period, Greece itself is constituted by hundreds of independent city-states that all have different governments, that all have their own militaries and their own foreign policy and their own customs. And, you know, Sparta and Athens are all held up as the two that sort of were the most different from each other. And Sparta is often compared to Egypt or to Persia as having more in common with them than they do with their fellow Greeks. So if we think about these as meditations that Herodotus is presenting to a Greek audience that might resonate with them, what do you think he might be saying to his Greek readers or Greek listeners if he's reading it out loud? Anyone want to try to think about our sort of the, what we might learn about the Greeks from Herodotus here instead of about these other cultures?
That's a broad question.
I mean, one of the things we want to keep in mind throughout the book, all the entirety of Herodotus, especially if we sort of look back at that question number two that we have, where sometimes you can actually define the Greeks by what the other culture is not. But so we want to always be thinking about the fact that Herodotus is a Greek and he's writing for Greeks. So what might they want to take away? What can we learn about the Greeks from any of this? This is sort of a tough question to think about. But it's been the question that has sort of structured approaches to understanding Herodotus since the last three decades, is what can we actually learn about the Greeks, especially once we realize that we can't take this as a face value document about those other an accurate representation of those other cultures necessarily.
Leah here, he starts off 3.38 saying, "I am convinced by all the evidence that Cambyses was seriously deranged." And he goes on to tell his story of eating the people who eat the dead parents and the outrage that caused, and this whole thing with money and power. And it almost seems as if Herodotus is warning the Greeks of Cambyses and Darius's mistakes. And, you know, custom is king of all, meaning be respectful almost.
Ironically, of course, that famous line, the custom is king, is a quotation of another Greek writer.
Exactly, Pindar.
Yeah, he's applying a Greek aphorism to his analysis of our Persian kings. So we get this other aspect of the sort of Greekness of Herodotus' approach. So we have about 10 minutes left, and I thought maybe what we do is we just sort of see if there are any other passages or sections that people want to bring up for discussion and share around with others from any parts of this. I'll go ahead and start with Bill if he still has any additional thoughts or ideas that you want to throw out to everybody.
The one which is really not, I think, key to the discussion this evening is the these military campaigns that they undertake. The scope, the scale, and the distances are staggering. Even if they're fictional, they're staggering to think that in that period of time, you could conceive of mounting up 50,000 troops and just marching off someplace several hundred miles away. And they repeat that time after time in these journeys. And even the distances that Herodotus himself covers in zipping around to visit all the various oracles, some of these are 600-700 kilometers from where he's allegedly writing.
And they just, get there in the afternoon.
Yeah, I guess so. Anyway, the campaigns are quite fascinating. The campaigns that accompany this portion of text are quite fascinating in their complexity. And I wonder if it's perhaps a subtle message to the Greeks as well there, that these are people who have greater capacity for making war than you do.
I mean, think about the logistics involved in all of this. It's just staggering. And this is something we want to keep in mind, I think, when we go to book four, because book four pivots on a campaign of Darius into Scythia. So we're going to see some of this discussion and the sort of military aspects of this are going to be focused in book four, in addition to the Scythian digression. But that's going to come down to a discussion of tactics, in fact. Alex, did you want to add anything? Just sort of a part of the reading that you found that we haven't discussed at all that you'd like to bring up, or do you want to comment on Bill at all?
Sure, a couple of things. First of all, his commentary on the Iliad I thought was quite amusing. It's like, why would the Trojans risk their city over Helen? They would just give her back. It's,
yes.
It's not realistic.
And, it's one of those, you realize that the Greeks actually weren't there for Helen. They were there for the city.
And another comment on custom is king. I think we can perhaps view that as a key to Herodotus's methodology. Because if custom is king, then that's sort of a justification for his approach, which looks at, well, the culture of every nation. Because if ultimately culture is the determinant of historical events, then those are the most important bits, not the biography of Cyrus or whatever.
Yeah, and so you might want to sort of fuse the two, what are often seen as these sort of distinct portions of the history, the military narrative, the sort of history of the war proper versus the cultural things, and recognize that for Herodotus, these conflicts often come from misunderstandings of cultural relations, their cultural relations, intercultural activities, and that war arises either because of misunderstanding or because of refusal to take into account the differences in some ways. Andrew, are you still there? Do you want to add anything in?
Yeah, my favorite part, what was most fascinating to me was the close relationship between religion and sexuality in Egypt. There's a lot of discussion of phalluses in religious festivals. That was quite remarkable, including paragraph 48, the festival of Dionysus, which is actually the festival of Osiris, which included marionettes with penises that women carry that move. Fascinating. You wouldn't expect that in a religious festival of any kind. And section or paragraph 64, where he writes, all other peoples except for the Egyptians and Hellenes do have intercourse in sanctuaries, believing as they do that people are just like animals, because they see all types of animals and birds mounting each other in the temples and assume that the animals would not do this unless the god approved of it. And then he concludes with an almost Victorian aside. Now, I find this explanation to be quite disagreeable. And you'll notice at a couple of sections in Book 2 where he's discussing these festivals of Osiris, where he says, religious scruple causes me to not even mention the name of the god. I knew that the Osiris religion involved something about Osiris having a golden phallus or something, but I didn't realize that this actually permeated the religious festivals that went on in Egypt. That is quite a shock.
Well, actually, the whole phallus being paraded around is a Greek thing, too. The Athenians in the festival of Dionysus, you carried phalluses around with
now,
you.
Now, that's fact, another okay, that's another question I have now. Because he's always... I'm sorry?
I think the Greeks would have been jealous that the Egyptians had ones that moved.
Well, that's another question I had here, was he's always talking about, well, you know, the Egyptians call Demeter Isis, and it's just always, well, the Egyptian gods are the same as the Greek gods. They just have different names.
Yep.
How do historians sort this stuff out?
Very carefully. Or not at all. This is something that we refer to often as historical syncretism, where oftentimes when you read these cultural documents like this, there's often an attempt to understand foreign religion by making a connection with a known god or goddess, so that even if you know that they didn't worship the god in that other place under the same name as the Greeks did, but the way that the Greeks seem to often have tried to understand it was, you know, polytheistic. So they just assume that the gods are all the same. They just have different names and different attributes. When you find something that sort of stands out, the idea that for a Greek, you had specific animals that were sacrificed to specific gods. That's normal for them. And so when they find that in Egypt, it's almost like, okay, we get this. When you have things like the parade of the phalluses, the reason why he says it's the Egyptian festival of Dionysus is because that's how they worship Dionysus. Dionysus is a fertility god, and so phalluses are often associated with him and are in fact paraded around. The outside of homes were something called herms, which are these statues with erect penises that were meant to ward off evil, because everyone knows erect penises ward off evil.
Yes, of course.
But so there are these sort of similarities, but then you see things that sort of pop up as what he considers, what are considered unusual or wrong, and often that is gods that are hybrid animals. That would just not work for a Greek. And so that right. often is pointed out as something that's sort of disagreeable or that he doesn't comprehend. So when they actually give it a Greek name, that's often because it's an assimilation process. It's sort of mental assimilation. Whereas when they try to keep it at a distance, that means it's something that they can't find a cultural equivalent for.
But do you think that the Greeks actually adapted this festival of Osiris and used that as the basis for the festival of Dionysus?
I think it's really, this is the type of question that gets into into that sort of what we often refer to as the Dark Ages, sort of the Bronze Age period. We know there was cultural exchange in the 14th through 12th centuries, 11th centuries, and then we have sort of nothing, and then we have no documentation, and then we have this particular cult in Greece doesn't really date back prior to the 6th century. As far as we can tell.
So we have to assume Egyptian priority.
We don't know, because we don't have any evidence for this happening other than the Herodotus passage.
Okay.
And we know that, you know, that the cult of Isis and the cult of Osiris and stuff actually did start to get imported as their Egyptian cult in the 5th century into Greece. So you actually see the appearance of them being worshipped as Egyptian gods starting to emerge in the 5th century. So whether they actually, I'm sure the Mediterranean was a cultural hotbed. I'm sure that there was a lot of cultural exchange going on. You see similarities in religious practices all over the Mediterranean. So I'm sure there's a lot of cross-fertilization going on. But whether they are the Greek practices directly derived from the Egyptian practice, I don't think we'll ever know that, because we don't have evidence for this particular practice in Egypt prior to this text. So that's one of our big problems. So does anybody have anything, sort of closing remarks that they want to add? Maybe Fred or Leah, before we sign off for the night?
Actually, this is Katarina. I wanted to bring up one thing that I thought was really fascinating, just how he discussed mercy and compassion. How you'd find people suddenly at death's door, and if they had a witty remark or, somehow said something clever, they might be spared. I thought that was really, that was interesting. And I wonder today if, you know, that kind of compassion exists, because I was thinking about what's going on in the Middle East and with ISIS, and could these hostages ever appeal to compassion, or have we lost compassion now? And then it made me think about maybe Herodotus, part of his message anyway, Herodotus' message, not just to the Greeks, but to all of us, is do we see any part of ourselves in these stories? Because I think that you could still say that a lot of this is relevant today, and we can see it in that context, and we can think more deeply about these kinds of things, like what is compassion, what are lies, you know, that whole discussion when they talked about lies. There are a lot of different pieces that you could really sit with for a while.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's something we always want to be keeping on our radar. There's a reason why this text is still read and taught today, why it still is translated and published. It's because there's a lot in here that resonates or could resonate with us in the modern world. Anyone else want to add a couple of things in, anything in before we sign off? Or should we go ahead and call tonight?
Leah? Yeah, this is Leah. And I just, another one of my favorite parts in book three was the Samian tunnels, sort of page 234 and 237. I was so happy when we actually got pictures of this thing that actually does exist. You know, in other books, it's been like, oh, is this real? He thinks like hippopotamus is a horse bear, and he's wrong about all these things. He's right about this, and I just think it's so fascinating. And the editor, Robert Strassler, also included pictures and a map, and I totally want to visit.
Yeah, and actually, just sort of to sign off for the evening with one last thing. If you want to actually see the way that Darius represented his own ascent to the Persian throne over Cambyses, there is a wonderful monument carved into the side of a mountain in Iran, which obviously you can't go to, but it is called the Bisitun inscription, B-I-S-I-T-U-N. And if you just look that up online, you will find images and the text translated into English. It was posted in three different languages, carved onto the side of a mountain, on Darius's own tale about how he gained the throne over who he actually says was the false Smirdis, who has a different name in Persian, obviously. So that's something you guys might want to look into, because the story that Darius gives us is not the same one that Darius gives us, and it's also not the same one as we have in other Greek sources. It's clear that there were competing stories coming out of Persia over the course of the 5th and 5th centuries. So it's really fascinating stuff. Thank you, everyone, for calling in, and we'll have our next call coming a month from now. And hopefully all of you got the message about the change in time for the Paul Cartledge final call in March, and we'll make sure that information is updated for everyone as we move forward. So thank you again, and we will see you in a month.
Thank you, Rebecca.
Thank you.
Night, everybody.
Good night, everyone. Good night.
Good night.